Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have Jeff Fritz, who is an old friend from way back. He is the principal program manager at Microsoft, working on digital events and content for Blazor. Did I get that right, Jeff?
Yeah, that sums it up a little bit. Absolutely.
Great. Well, there's a lot to ask you then and talk about. One of the things you said just before we started was that you were working on Azure static websites.
Yeah.
You know what Azure is. I don't know what a static website is on Azure.
So when we typically think of a website that's running in the cloud, right? You've got a significant server component, right? It's PHP, it's Node, it's Ruby on Rails, it's ASP.NET Core. It's a significant component that's running and taking a lot of processor, and we have to measure how much processor because it's rendering HTML that's being delivered into the browser, yada, yada, yada. What if we could just deliver static HTML, just the static resources we need, CSS, images, JavaScript, or with Blazor, we can deliver WebAssembly DLLs, and everything just gets downloaded and runs in the browser, a lot like a progressive web application, right? Those PWAs. Well, when we actually do need to interact with data, let's keep those entries as small as possible, and we'll use something like Azure Functions then to run, so we can write just a little bit of code that...
I'm sorry, that was Azure what, Jeff?
Azure Functions.
Functions, okay.
Yeah, let's use Azure Functions to listen, right? Use that serverless technology so we write really small methods that listen on an HTTP endpoint, just like a web server might, but we'll just listen for push requests or get requests from them whenever we need to interact with a database or application server, something like that. But I mean, of course, we're on Azure. We've got all these cool applications and things that are already spun up for us that we can reach out and interact with. So interacting with any application on Azure and reaching into Azure Storage or Azure Search, so we can use the search indexing and search engine capabilities, real easy to do without having to write a lot of code. Spin up the extra service, connect it in, and now I'm using code in the browser written in C# because I like Blazor WebAssembly to reach out and interact with all these Azure services. Fantastic. And I'm not paying for processor.
Right. Okay. You've said about 12 things I want to follow up on.
All right. Let's do it.
And I'm not sure that I even caught everything. So let's go through what you just said, if you can, very slowly. And I'll ask you questions I didn't want to interrupt you, but I'll ask you about the parts that are not obvious.
Okay.
So you've got a web page.
Yep.
And that web page is static in what sense? I mean, obviously, it's not that the page, nothing happens. So in what sense is it static?
So the web page is static in the sense that there is no server component that is generating the HTML. All of the files that we're serving to it are the same files that were written to disk. No interpretation, no parsing. Everything that was written to disk is served to the browser in exactly the same format that it resides on disk.
Okay, and tell me the advantage of that.
The advantage of that is I don't have any processor or memory cost. It's really cheap and extremely performant to just send data from the web server that's already written to disk. I don't have to have a compiler or an interpreter wake up and parse and generate some code that's going to be sent down to the browser. What's on disk is what's being painted in the browser. Fantastic. Already pre-compiled, already has all the configuration in it that it needs, and the browser just has to paint the screen.
Okay, now I often ask questions just to get clarity, but this time I'm really confused. Is this, when you say on disk, is that on Azure or on my machine?
No, on Azure, right? Okay. So on the web server on Azure, we have our HTML written to disk that has all the layout, all the tags for our web pages, and we've got all of our CSS, images, fonts, all of those things sitting there inside the web server, and the web server isn't actually parsing any of that content. It's not rendering anything. It's just delivering what's written on disk.
Right. Okay, great. Now it sends me a page, mm-hmm. and I push the button, mm-hmm. and I expect something to come back.
Right. So the interaction in browser for the Blazor static websites that I like to use on Azure, that interaction, when you click the button, is being handled, interpreted by DLLs that are running in a .NET runtime that's been specially compiled to run on top of WebAssembly in the browser. Now, if that needs to get data from database or needs to save data to the database, it's going to reach out to an Azure function that's running right next to that static website, right next to that web server that delivered the HTML. And that function, that little C-sharp function that's running in the cloud, is going to turn around, relay that request into the database to fetch data or maybe update data or access and perform some interaction on our application server and return an appropriate response that will be parsed by, in my case, WebAssembly. Other folks will do this with JavaScript. And the Blazor WebAssembly will decide how to repaint the screen, and everybody's happy.
Okay, great. You mentioned two things I want to follow up on.
Sure.
WebAssembly. Is that intrinsic to Blazor, or that is how Blazor talks to the web?
So WebAssembly is the HTML5 standard capability that's in every web browser that allows the browser to run native code. It knows how to parse and execute binary code. And there's all kinds of folks out there that have built compilers that target WebAssembly. So whether it's C# and Razor making up what we call Blazor, that user interface framework compiles down to a binary that targets WebAssembly. There's other ones out there where you can program with C++, you can program with Rust, you can program with all kinds of different programming languages. Which is take your pick. They will compile down to a binary that targets the WebAssembly machine that runs inside the browser.
Okay, that's great. And that was a great explanation. Now, you talked about, along the way, you mm-hmm. talked about Azure Functions.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give me a quick lesson on what Azure Functions are and how they go about their business?
Sure. So Azure Functions are the serverless solution that's available from Microsoft Azure, right? This is the way for us as .NET developers, and you can use other technologies to write these as well. But as a .NET developer, I can write just a method, a static method in a C# class that will handle an HTTP request. We get past the contents of that request. We can go take whatever actions we need to and return an appropriate response to whatever made that request. Now, you aren't limited to just HTTP requests, and we can handle all the different HTTP verbs in that request. We can handle a get, a post, a put, a delete. It's up to you how you want to handle those requests that come in. But we can also trigger our interactions using other services like Azure Queues or Azure Table Storage or interactions and updates from a Cosmos DB database. So when we see these interactions happen, we can trigger additional functions to go and do additional processing. So the canonical example that folks use to show here's a cool Azure function working is they'll stand up a function that listens for an HTTP post. And what people will do is they'll post an image. Hey, I'm creating a photo album application, so let me post an image file. So I'm uploading a photo. Here's a photo of my family. We're at a museum, blah, blah, blah. Well, they put that photo onto a queue. That queue triggers another function that wakes up when it sees, hey, there's a new image out here. And that queue will analyze and create a thumbnail. So you've written two functions. The one is dormant until it sees a message with an image on that queue and goes and does its processing, while the first one is just sitting out there listening for requests and publish commands that come in with here's a new image to post into my photo album. That's kind of the canonical example that folks will talk about when they look at Azure Functions. The wonderful bit about Azure Functions is not only are you writing these little elements of code, just a method in C# that's going to handle these interactions, but it runs on what they call a consumption model. So for us as developers, we don't have to manage how many servers are out there running to handle all of these requests. What the Azure Functions runtime and service does is it will look at how much work is coming in, and they'll stand up an appropriate number of instances of applications that have our functions running to handle the workload coming through. So think about this, Jesse. If you have an article that goes on the front page of Reddit and you're going to have tens of thousands of people all coming through in the morning because they're having their coffee and they want to read the article, that's a lot of traffic coming through. And if they're all clicking a like button or they're all putting comments on there, if that's running against your one web server, you're going to get that server knocked over. That's a lot of traffic, right? What the Azure Functions will do is it'll see, oh, we're getting a lot of traffic. Let me stand up a couple more instances. And I'm not charged for the processor. I'm charged for how many executions happen. So after that morning glut of tens of thousands of requests to get data and those interactions with the content that my functions support, when it slows down in the afternoon and eventually stops, my charges stop because nothing's executing. Nothing's happening in my functions. So that works out real nicely for us because the platform scales appropriately to deliver a consistent experience.
Two things come up right away from that. Sure. If I'm a small business and I have limited budget and I get hit by a lot of transactions like that, am I looking at a lot of money at that point, or is this within normal server kinds of prices?
This is within normal server kinds of crisis. These are the good problems to have. You published an website, you published an application, and a lot of people are coming to it. That's great. You can control how much it scales up so that it effectively throttles those requests. And you can set up caching in front of it as well so that it limits it. It maintains a certain threshold and a certain usability as folks come through and work with your application.
Well, I have been saying since 2001, I think, that Guthrie is a genius, and he just keeps proving it. What he's done with Azure is just amazing. I think, frankly, that Microsoft missed an opportunity because when the vaccines first came out, everybody had a different website. Most of them were terrible. Mm-hmm. All of them were unreliable. Mm-hmm. If they had built a universal system, because everybody knew for at least a year it was coming, mm-hmm. if they had built a universal system built on their technology that was held by Azure so it had, 100% reliability, what an advertisement that would have been. But water under the bridge.
I think I look at things like healthcare.gov and how the government wants to have ownership of those types of resources.
Yes.
I don't think they were going to be bringing in a contractor or vendor like Microsoft to provide that kind of capability.
Unless Microsoft gave it away, but that's another debate.
Exactly. Exactly. And there were other contractors that made deals with each of the individual states.
Yes, yes. And it was a disaster, I can tell you from a consumer point of view.
Oh, yes.
I digress. Let's talk about Blazor for a little bit.
Sure.
My understanding is, and it may be wrong, is that where in traditional, or I don't know how to put it, ASP.NET, you would write in Razor and the logic would be in JavaScript. Here, you're still using Razor, but the logic is C#. Do I have any of that right?
Yeah, yep, that's right.
Okay, so this makes a lot of sense if you're a C# programmer.
Oh, it does.
What if I have a lot of business logic written in C#,
mm-hmm.
and it's talking to SQL Server or whatever child of SQL Server we're up to now, and I want to get some kind of front end that I can present this data to my users?
Mm-hmm.
Does Blazor enter the picture at that point?
Certainly does. So the way that I tell people to think about Blazor is all the things that we've done with XAML are really cool, but you need a native renderer for it, whether it's Xamarin Forms, Xamarin Applications, WPF, UWP. You need some sort of native renderer that runs on that operating system that's going to parse the XAML and paint it appropriately. And you've got these frameworks that all of them use a slightly different dialect of XAML. But what if we can do those same types of interactions, have similar markup, but let's take advantage of the one true markup that everybody in the world uses, HTML. So if we can take HTML and if we can bind our attributes, if we can data bind values in our form elements that are already very clearly defined and deliver that component-based user interface framework, now we've got something. Now we've got something that builds on the promise of XAML that gives you all the hooks into your favorite programming language, C#, and connects into that universal markup language of HTML. And we can style it with CSS and all the derivations of that, SAS, LESS, what have you. That's a pretty cool thing. That's a pretty cool thing. And Jesse, I'll take it even one further. As a developer, I don't care where it executes. If it runs in the browser, that's really cool. You're going to get immediate response after all those DLLs load up in the browser and render. Or maybe I want it to run on the server because I don't want to expose those DLLs. I mean, as programmers who deliver applications that may run on a desktop, we know not to trust our end users with the contents of our application. They're going to decompile it. They're going to hack it. They're going to push back to servers, to endpoints, and we need to do a second verification there anyway. So maybe instead I just want my application running on the server so I don't have to think about that. Well, Blazor components run on the server also. Fantastic. So I can take my pick of where I want it to run. In the browser with a tree shaken and linked .NET runtime, or maybe I have it run on the server where I've got all the mighty power of the cloud able to deliver and scale appropriately as more folks interact with the website. It's our choice. And the fact that I can write Blazor code that renders the same in both environments, I'm the winner here. The end users who are going to interact with our application, they're going to have a great experience no matter what. But as a developer, I get the ultimate flexibility that I want.
Okay, that sounds mind-blowingly great. Talk to me a little bit, when I'm building this application, about the relationship between C# and Razor.
Sure. So as ASP.NET developers, we're used to programming with the Razor templating language. We've had that around since the days of, what, MVC version 3.0, 2.0? It's almost 10 years old that we've had Razor markup available to us. And that's traditionally been rendered on a server, interpreted and rendered on a server with a little bit of logic, data interactions that happen as part of the ASP.NET application. Okay, that's fine. But the step up that happened is we took that markup and we were able to turn it around, add some extra capabilities into it so that we didn't just have, well, format elements as such, but to make the interactions with the Razor templating language richer, so we could do two-way binding with form elements. So we could do a rich component framework that's all tag-based, and we're able to pass parameters between components very easily. Layer into that some dependency injection, and we've got a very full-featured framework that's been maturing for almost 10 years, knows how to interact with C#. And for us as developers that have been around ASP.NET MVC for that whole time, you already know how to use this. You just need to learn a couple of these new keywords that have been introduced. And Blazor is going to be a pretty powerful thing for you.
If you're a C# programmer, but you're not a web programmer, you're not an ASP.NET programmer, mm-hmm. Your boss comes to you and says, okay, we need a web front end to the thing you've been working on.
Yep.
What's the learning curve, assuming we're using Blazor?
So if you've done HTML at any point, you know the markup at this point. You've got the basics down. To get the important parts around component management, how you're going to interact with those components, it'll probably take you a day or two to get the basics down cold. There isn't that much to it. Learning how to interact with the form elements, how the component system works, how to integrate components back and forth, it fits what we've been doing for years almost too well. It's pretty exciting when you see just how easy it is to adjust to it.
1 or 2 days, I'm going to hold you to that, Fritz.
Go for it. Absolutely.
When does Blazor start handling C# 9? Will that be at the time that C# 9 is released?
So C# 9 was released as part of .NET 5 in November 2020 at .NET Conf. So we're in. It's using C# 9 in the current version that's published here as of May 2021. That means that our applications can take advantage of all those cool new features in C# 9. Now, okay, you're not going to do a top-level program with Blazor. You might do some pattern matching. You might do some of the new advanced pattern matching, and you might take advantage of some of the init accessors. That's some cool stuff. Sure, you can take advantage of that. And that's great stuff. We really enjoy seeing that Blazor gets to take advantage of those things because it runs on the same compiler, the same command line tools that we've been using for .NET Core for years now, going on almost 5 years of .NET Core. But that also means that as Blazor matures and other features get into .NET Core, we're going to see that helping out Blazor. So the key feature here that I'm looking forward to in .NET 6 that's going to make our development experience even better is a feature called Hot Reload. So, remember back in the day we had Edit and Continue for our ASP.NET websites? I mean, we've had Hot Reload for WPF and Xamarin for a little bit now, where, right, there's the little toolbar that appears at the top of your WPF app, and you can click and move things around and have it force it to refresh the user interface, right?
Right.
But how do you do that with Blazor and ASP.NET, where you've got a web server that's running, and we're going to end up writing code that needs to be rebuilt and restart the web server, yada, yada, yada. Well, they've done it. You can set up in .NET 6 Preview 3 and going forward, they're iterating on this and making it better. You can tell the .NET .NET command line tools to watch your files for changes. Now, we've been able to do that for a bit, and it'll restart the web server, and you have to refresh the web page, log back in, and blah, blah, blah. It's a pain in the neck. But what they have done is they're now detecting the differences, the change in the website, and they're pushing those updates immediately into the browser. So the example that we can give is that you can change text, you can change label, you can change a calculation on your Razor markup, and when you hit save, almost immediately in the browser, you'll see it recompiles and reflects that code change that you wrote for WebAssembly. It already reloaded everything and just starts working with the new code. It's so pretty amazing.
In Xamarin, Hot Reload works with the markup. You're saying that in Blazor it works with the code.
It works with both the markup and the C# code that's attached to it. Yes. And this is part of a consistent effort that you're going to see as part of .NET 6 across the entire offering, where we want to get Hot Reload working for not just markup, but for the C# code across the entire .NET offering.
So this is a merger between Hot Reload and I wish I had started to
and edit and continue. Yeah.
Yes.
This is edit and continue.
What I was looking for.
Yeah, yeah. This is edit and continue version next, where you aren't even saying stop. You aren't even saying continue. You're just saying edit. And when you hit that save button, it automatically updates everything. So
okay, let's talk a little bit about cadence. We've got Core 6. That's not what it's going to be called.
Mm-mm.
It's going to be called .NET 6.
Right. We've got .NET 5 now.
Yep.
We're sunsetting the core nickname for .NET Core, for ASP.NET Core. So .NET Core 3.1 is the last version of the framework that has that moniker. And since we're merging together all the .NETs, we're bringing Xamarin into .NET, that's where decision was made. Well, let's drop that core nickname and let's just call it .NET 5. .NET right. 6 is the next version. Yeah.
And that comes out
November,
no promises, 22. But
no.
November of...
November 21, I'm sorry.
Yes, November of 21. Will Blazor have some sort of cadence that's tied to that?
Absolutely. We're updating all of the frameworks at the same time. And you will see Blazor, you'll see WPF, you'll see WinForms, ASP.NET Core. That's going to maintain the core nickname with it. But Xamarin becomes .NET MAUI. That all releases as one big package. November 2021.
And every developer's head explodes.
Well, so here's the deal. We've been pitching this now for the better part of a year and a half, that we are going to have a consistent release cadence of November each year. You're going to get new versions of .NET runtime and frameworks that go along with it. So in this way, everybody can plan for and they know this is when the next .NET version is going to be released. So we can spend our spring and summer experimenting and testing and tinkering with that next version as it gets ready to be released in November. That also means that we know when the support cycles are, because what we've declared as a .NET team is that the even numbered versions going forward, so starting with .NET 6, you're going to get that as a long-term support. You get 3 years of support for free when you use one of the even numbered versions of .NET going forward. So .NET Core 3.1 is a long-term support version. You're going to continue to get support for that. I believe it's through 2022, but .NET 6 is the next long-term support when that's released in November 2021, and you'll have support for that through 2024. But here's the thing. We expect to release .NET 7 in 2022 and .NET 8 in 2023. So .NET 8 is released. That's also a long-term support. You end up then with a year of overlap where you have .NET 6 and .NET 8 available in the 2024 timeframe.
Yes. So,
planning wise, for folks that are trying to manage change in their ecosystems, in their environments, you know exactly when things are going to be coming out and when to plan for migrations.
Okay. What about C Sharp? Is it going to be on that same cadence or will it be on its own?
C Sharp, we're getting a brand new version each year, and you're going to see smaller updates to the language as those various features are released. So there's some things that are in the pipeline that have been proposed for C Sharp 10.
Let me switch subjects on you.
Sure.
And ask about core, sorry, strike that, and ask about .NET 6. When is it an appropriate time for a developer who does not want to be on the cutting edge? When's a good time to start playing with that?
I would recommend, if you want to wait for a more stable release, get involved in about September, October. That's about when we expect to see release candidates as the feature lockdown is complete. They're really in bug fix polish mode at that point, and you shouldn't see significant changes to APIs at that point. The concepts, okay, the feature load that's going to be delivered is locked in, and that's about the time frame that you'll see release candidates that are going to be good for folks to interact with.
And when will Microsoft documentation be providing support for .NET Core 6? I cannot not say it. .NET 6?
So we expect to see documentation updated as the fall happens, and we do have those locked in capabilities. There might be one or two preview articles out there that talk about some of the preview features, but while we're in preview mode like this, there is no support for the current version. We're looking for folks to interact on our GitHub, issues, to provide feedback, what works, what doesn't work. We expect them to be pretty much in lockstep with the developers while we're iterating on the code and building towards those release candidates in the fall.
Jeff, you're a font, and I can't thank you enough for doing this.
Thank you. It's always fun.